Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of May. Hellhound on his trail, the stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the international hunt for his assassin. The author, Hampton Sides, is our guest this hour. Hampton is the editor of Outside and author of History's Blood and Thunder and Ghost Soldiers, which was the basis for the 2005 Miramax film, The Great Raid. In conjunction with the publication of his book, Roads to Memphis, a two-hour documentary is going to premiere on May 3rd on PBS, told through eyewitness testimony from King's inner circle and the officials involved in Ray's capture and prosecution. And Hampton interviewed many, many people and read a great deal of diaries and did a heck of a lot of research for this very, very good book. It traces what was going on with James Earl Ray and what was going on with Martin Luther King at the same time in the months before his assassination. Also, J. Edgar Hoover is featured in this book, and it is remarkable in its detail, particularly about James Earl Ray. I didn't know all that I learned about him as a result of this. George Wallace also figures prominently in this book and in the motivation for certain actions on the part of James Earl Ray, who was a big campaigner for George Wallace, which also raises a lot of questions. So we should have a pretty interesting hour here. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. And Hampton, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
You start with your memories of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination, and it's you were very, very young, but it's a story that so deeply affected you that ultimately you came back to write this book many years later.
Well, I grew up in Memphis, and, you know, the Martin Luther King assassination was the first thing I really remember, the first time I ever remember history happening, the glare of the world, you know, bearing down on my hometown. I remember seeing tanks. I remember seeing the National Guard on Main Street. And, you know, I just had that feeling, I think we all did, that the city was ripping apart. My father worked for a law firm that represented the garbage workers that went on strike and represented King when he came to lead a march. And so I heard a lot from my dad about it. But I wanted to go back after all these years and just sort of reconstruct or maybe deconstruct this event and try to understand it, try to understand also who James Earl Ray was, this mysterious stranger who wanders into my hometown and changes history. So it kept me busy for about 3 years and took me all over the world, but I keep circling back to Memphis in this story.
And I learned so much about James Earl Ray. I never knew that much about him, and he left a trail, but you certainly traced it all over the world, didn't you?
Well, even I think so much has been written about, you know, either advancing or debunking conspiracy theories about Ray. Did he do it or did he not? But there really hadn't been books about, all right, who was James Earl Ray? What were his movements? What were his travels? What were his habits? What were his possible motivations? And that's really what I focused on. The guy did get around. I mean, you know, this manhunt for James Earl Ray went for about 65 days and multiple continents and countries, and I tried to go to as many of these places as I could to kind of begin to understand, you know, his habits.
You found, toward the end of the book, you found his father, and his father had some really, they hit you right in the face kinds of comments about what he thought about African-Americans and what he thought about his son.
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't find him. He's long since passed away, but the FBI agents found him. See, all his life, James Earl Ray told people that his dad had passed away, had died of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was embarrassed by his dad or something. So It took the FBI a while to figure out that he, in fact, was alive and well then and living on a farm in Missouri. And they track him down and get some sense of the background of the Ray family. I mean, it was a miserably poor and racist family with a lot of strange ideas. He would say things like, you know, you can't get anywhere in life. Everything's a racket. The little man is always pushed down. All politicians are liars, except for George Wallace, he said. And that, you know, all Chinese food, you don't eat Chinese food. They're trying to poison you. You know, all baseball games are fixed. You know, this kind of philosophy seeped down to James Earl Ray as a kid growing up in Illinois and Missouri. And I think it deeply affected him.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple things that really struck me. First, that everybody who ran into him, be it in California or Puerto Vallarta, or described his appearance, that he had this kind of pasty look, like he hadn't been outside for a long time, except when he was in Mexico when he got kind of tan, that he was standoffish, and they always commented on how he looked.
Yeah, or how he didn't look, almost. He had really developed a way of blending in. And he said he wanted to have a face that no one could remember. And he sort of fell in the statistical middle. Average height, average weight, average age. You know, he just was this generic character. And it was part of his M.O., I think, in terms of being a con man and being a stick-up artist and certainly in being an escape artist. He escaped from two maximum security prisons, and part of his MO was that no one really noticed him. And when he was gone, they didn't notice that he was gone. And that was something that he really struggled with. That was very deliberate.
Mm-hmm. Tell the story of it's almost like a Houdini-like thing where it got his body twisted, and he was practicing doing this into almost a pretzel to get in this bread box.
Yeah. He had been planning this escape for months, if not years, and he was working in the prison bakery at the state pen in Missouri, Jefferson City, Missouri. And he practiced getting into a bread box that was going to be filled with bread bound for the Honor Farm. And he would practice yoga and, you know, squeeze himself down into this very small amount of space. And then finally he got into the box, and he must have had an accomplice to put this. There was a false bottom put on top of him and more bread on top of that. They put him on the truck, and the truck got out of the prison, and he jumped out of the box, out of the truck, and wandered down the railroad tracks into history. But it was, people forget this guy escaped not from just one, but actually two maximum security prisons, because after the assassination, people may remember, he got out of a place called Brushy Mountain in Tennessee and was on the lam for 3 days before he was finally caught by bloodhounds.
Yeah. He has this real seedy life. You know, he picks up prostitutes in Mexico. He's kind of interested in pornography. He's talking his racist rhetoric in Mexico, gets into fights. I mean, it's really this seedy underground, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, let's just take his period in Los Angeles. He's doing all kinds of strange things. He's hanging out with prostitutes and go-go girls and getting deep into hypnosis and a number of unusual self-help books. He's playing around with the idea of becoming a porn director. He's also has graduated from a bartending class, and for some weird reason, he's also taking dancing lessons. He gets a nose job about a month before the assassination. There's a lot going on there. He's clearly struggling to figure out an identity, to find meaning in his life. He's clearly a lost soul. One of the few things that seems to really animate him and galvanize him is the George Wallace campaign for president. And I think it's clearly something that, you know, gave him some purpose. He went around trying to gather signatures and convince people to vote for Wallace. And, Wallace really spoke to him in a lot of ways.
He was a George Wallace volunteer.
Yeah, he was. And he was, Wallace decided when he ran for president that he had to get on the ballot in California first, which had a particularly onerous procedure where you had to get 66,000 signatures before you could even get on the ballot for a primary. And so they had these armies of people going out all over the streets of Los Angeles and other big cities gathering signatures. And that's primarily what Ray did. I say Ray. He had called himself Eric Galt, and that's the name he was using at the time. It's important to understand that Ray was constantly making up aliases.
Mm-hmm.
He had 39 aliases over the course of his criminal career. In the period that I write about, he has six or seven. He's Paul Bridgman. He's Harvey Lohmeyer. He's John Willard. He's Eric Galt. He's Ramon Snead. And on and on it goes. But during this period, he's known as Eric Galt.
And when does Martin Luther King start entering his mind? When does he move east?
Well, you know, the idea of killing King was something that he had talked about even earlier. Back in prison, he told people killing Martin Luther Coon, as he called him, was going to be his retirement plan. He clearly knew about some of the bounties that were out there on King's head. There were a number of them, one of them particularly coming out of St. Louis. So it's something sort of, as he escaped from prison and was moving around the country, it was something in the back of his mind. But on March 17th, 1968, when he was living in Los Angeles, Martin Luther King came to L.A. and gave a series of talks. Something he said in one of those speeches must have set Ray off. Because the next day, March 18th, he puts in a change of address form for Atlanta, Georgia. And he points his car east towards Atlanta and moves to Martin Luther King's hometown, a place he had no connection to, had no friends there. What's he doing living in MLK's hometown? But clearly something had happened in those series of speeches that he gave in L.A. that sort of set Ray off.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me as though it didn't take a whole lot to set Ray off when it came to race issues. You write about this encounter in a bar in Mexico, and he smashes somebody in the head, an African-American.
And he threatens to kill him, and there's another, and a couple of other incidences like this. There's one in a bar in Los Angeles, and, you know, I mean, I know that some people have said, well, how could Ray have done this when he wasn't a member of the Klan or something, but it's very clear that his racial views were deep and, you know, were deep seated. He was talking about immigrating already. He had already looked into immigrating to Rhodesia, which was this breakaway, you know, segregationist white supremacist state in Southern Africa. And you know, he was into the John Birch Society, and he was a big fan of this guy, J.B. Stoner, who published a hate rag, a horrible anti-Semitic and racist rag called The Thunderbolt. So there's no question about his racial views. It's very clear.
Right. Let's switch to Dr. Martin Luther King, who in the months prior to his assassination was plumb tired. He was exhausted, wasn't he? And he didn't have, and you don't think about this because we think of him in a different way now, didn't have the kind of influence that he had, and was about to embark on the Poor People's March, which was a change of direction. Talk
right
about his struggles at this time.
Yeah. Well, you know, King was still very much revered, but his movement was fraying. And there were, of course, a lot of different ideas about which direction it should go in. And there were some young radicals, charismatic young radicals, like Stokely Carmichael, and, you know, the Black Panthers and Black Power movement were sort of beginning to outflank King and his more sort of more tactically conservative, nonviolent movement. King had shifted his focus from pure civil rights to what he called economic justice, and the idea being, you know, to really look at and confront multi-generational poverty and what was going on in the inner cities of America. This in response to the horrible riots that had happened all over the country in the previous summers. So he had this idea to go to Washington to bring an army of poor people of all backgrounds, not just African Americans, and to build an enormous sort of shanty town on the Mall to protest poverty and to protest the war in Vietnam, because the idea being that, you know, all of our national treasure, such a large part of it, was going towards the war effort and not towards dealing with the conditions in the cities, in the inner cities. But needless to say, this was just an enormously controversial campaign he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't think he should be going to Washington. People worried that it was going to turn violent. Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, his age-old nemesis, said it was communism and this was subversion, and no doubt it was Soviet inspired, and he sort of saw communists under every rock. But this was the backdrop for the last few months of King's life. He was traveling constantly, trying to drum up support for this, smoking a lot, drinking more, gaining some weight. His aide said that he was waging a war on sleep because he was just so exhausted and forcing the staff to fan out all over the country to organize for this campaign.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, who's the author of Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. Hampton Sides is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hampton Sides, our guest this hour, Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. You bring up J. Edgar Hoover. Let's spend a little more time on him because Ramsey Clark as well. He was obsessed with Dr. King, convinced, you write, early in King's career that the civil rights leader was a tool of the Soviets, and in late 63 persuaded Attorney General Robert Kennedy to authorize the use of wiretaps and other surveillance to ferret out King's supposed communist ties.
Yeah, I mean, this goes way back. Hoover's distrust of King, it's really hard to understand exactly what his problem was with King. It was just... You know, perhaps he was a racist on some level. I think he, having grown up in Washington, D.C., felt almost like he was a protector of the morals of the District of Columbia. And he thought King was a commie and a subversive, and he just wanted his movement stopped. And he directed his field agents to go out and smear him and ruin him and try to embarrass him. Tried to prove that he was a communist. Well, they never found any evidence of that whatsoever. What they did find was some embarrassing information about King's extracurricular activities. He had some affairs. He had some mistresses. That's been well documented. But so Hoover was left trying to just make hay of this in some way to try to embarrass King. And no one would take the bait, though. Newspapers and magazines, people on the Hill that he tried to buttonhole with this information and say, look, you know, this minister is having these affairs. It all sort of backfired. None of these charges stuck. And this was a source of enormous frustration for Hoover because he could not seem to turn this embarrassing information into something that would... in King's career.
And why what was that? Was that just a sign of the times? Because now the fact that he had affairs would be on cable television 24/7 for at least a week.
Yeah. Well, I think it was an old boy kind of gentleman's agreement. Certainly there was with JFK, who had many more affairs and many more escapades.
Yes.
King's philanderings were of a different order than JFK's, believe me. But I think it was... very much different times, and it was very much an old boy network. All the journalists were guys, and everyone was winking. I guess I don't know, but I think you're right that if today this sort of thing would make the news or make the internet and go viral in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. And just to place again for those who don't remember this history, the reason King had been asked to go to Memphis. Can you tell the story? You contrast. What happened that day and how the papers treated, I think it was the birth of Elvis Presley's daughter,
yeah.
with the horrendous accident that killed a couple garbage workers in Memphis.
Right, right. Well, okay, so the garbage working force in Memphis was entirely black. They were mostly from the Mississippi Delta. Many of them had been cotton pickers, had been field hands. And, you know, they had moved to the city because of mechanization. There was machines doing the jobs in the fields in the Delta. And they came to Memphis, and most of them were it's almost like they moved from one plantation to another. And they were mistreated. They were not paid well. And they had these antiquated trucks that were quite dangerous. And one day, it was February 1st of 1968, two garbage workers were ground up in one of these faulty mechanisms. And, I mean, literally turned into garbage. And it was a horrible, horrible accident. The city didn't pay for their funeral and didn't have any money to pay for, or chose not to pay the families any sort of benefits. And so this was a provoking incident that led to the strike. They had a lot of other grievances that went back years. And they went around the streets of Memphis with those now famous signs that said, "I am a man," asking for just, you know, basic rights. King got the call to come speak to the organization, and he did. But that led to another speech and then a march, and, you know, he kind of got ensnared in this very local incident when his staff all thought, no, this is a mistake. You need to be working strictly on the Poor People's Campaign in Washington. But he said, you know what, this is the perfect local illustration of what we're trying to do. This is these are the poorest of the poor, garbage workers on strike in Memphis. This is exactly what we're talking about. So before he made his right turn into Washington, he made a left turn into Memphis, and that's, of course, what led to his death.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jim from Brookfield. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Yes, Jim, go ahead.
Yes, fascinating show. My family, I worked for a company headquartered in Memphis for 30 years, and we lived there for 4 years. My boss had worked for, I believe, Mayor Loeb was the mayor at the time.
Yeah.
And he told me this many times that in April, April 4th of 68, that word came down in City Hall that something was coming down and that no fire or police were to respond. And that was the rule. And, of course, he essentially bled to death after Dr. King was shot.
Well, I mean, I don't understand that, because there were hundreds of cops on the scene within 1 or 2 minutes. He was at the hospital, taken to the hospital, and was there within 8 minutes. And he lived for a whole hour before he did finally die in the hospital. So I'm not really, I don't get that. That doesn't really make sense. There was an enormous response, but I, you know, it'd be interesting to hear, you know, hear that out a little bit more and hear what they were talking about.
Unfortunately, my former boss committed suicide a number of years ago. But another issue that I had heard is that when he checked in to the Lorraine, he was in a first floor room, and when he came back the day he was killed, they had moved him to the upper area. Is that true?
Well, that is sort of true. He got into town early, and the room that he liked to stay in, when he came to Memphis, he always stayed at the Lorraine. It was his favorite hotel, and it was the only all black-owned and black-run hotel in the whole city. And he usually stayed in 306. It was called the King Abernathy Suite. He'd been there over a dozen times before, but it was already occupied. So they checked him into a room below just so he could have a room to you know, relax in for a few hours before the other tenant left. But I know that a lot of conspiracy theories, you know, exist about this. They say that he was, you know, shepherded or forced to go into this room against his will or something. But Abernathy talks at great length in the hearings in Washington about how this was their room. They liked it. This was the place they usually stayed, and they wanted that room.
Tell us the story of Abernathy and King being in needing to get away, and I think it was Acapulco. Didn't they go to Acapulco? And
yeah, that's right. Yeah, shortly, a few months before the assassination, I mean, it was clear to everyone that King was exhausted, that he needed a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was getting all these death threats, and it was really weighing on him in so many different ways. He was, you know, you could just see it in his eyes. He needed a break. So they decided to go to Acapulco. And Abernathy was his best friend. They traveled together. They stayed together, usually. Abernathy was the number two in the organization and just a great, dear, old friend of his. They went to Acapulco, and the first night they were there, Abernathy woke up like 3 in the morning and noticed that King wasn't in his bed, and he wasn't in the other room, and he wasn't in the bathroom, and he was really worried that something was up. And then he went out on the balcony and found him there, alone in his thoughts, staring at this enormous rock with the waves washing over it, and, you know, quite in despair. And they sit out there on the balcony and start singing an old spiritual, and, you know, he's just clearly full of worry, one of those middle-of-the-night moments. And it's a pretty poignant scene that, you know, Abernathy talked about in the hearings in Washington.
Right. And then goes on to be expressed by King in that famous speech shortly thereafter.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about that a little bit. I mean, it's an extraordinary speech, the mountaintop speech
that he gave on
April 3rd. What's extraordinary also about it is that he wasn't going to give it. He was in his motel at the Lorraine. He had a cold. There were tornado warnings and thunderstorms, and it was clear to him, at least, that there wasn't going to be a very big crowd, and he really was so exhausted that he just was going to stay there and send Abernathy to go and just greet the few they expected to show up. Abernathy gets there, and there's almost 4,000 people who've braved the elements to come out to hear King. And so Abernathy immediately calls him and says, you know, you got to get here. This is your crowd. And so he comes without notes and stands up there and gives this speech of his life. In many ways, it's one of his greatest orations, completely extemporaneous. But he does seem to prefigure his own death. I mean, he talks about longevity has its place, and I may not get there with you, and you know,
yes.
I've been to the mountaintop, and I've looked over, but, you know, he may not get there. And he also talks in another part of the speech about all the threats that were out there from what he called our sick white brothers. And, you know, it's in many ways a rather morbid speech. He seemed to be predicting something, but it's also true that he had been touching on many of these same themes in speeches and in sermons for months. His staff was quite worried about him because he talked so much about what's going to happen if he dies and who's going to take over and who's going to preach his, you know, jokingly he would say who's going to preach his eulogy. And, you know, he very much seemed to see the end. And it's just that speech, kind of all these different themes come together in this really dramatic way. And, you know, I don't think that he predicted that it was going to happen tomorrow, you know, at 6:01 at the Lorraine, but mm-hmm. he certainly seemed to see an end coming.
And talk, before we go back to phone calls, let's switch to, by then, Galt. I think his name is Galt at this point. His days before, how he sees a picture of King standing in front of room 306 somewhere in the press, and how he makes his way to Memphis.
Yeah. Well, this is another thing that, you know, people are puzzled by, understandably puzzled. Like, how did Ray Galt, how did he learn that they were staying at the Lorraine? And the answer is just really simple, and sadly very simple, is that the local newspaper, the Commercial Appeal, published the fact that they were staying at the Lorraine. They did this because some marshals had come to issue an injunction to King saying he could not march and that they were going to have to go into court to hash it out. And so they had to hand-deliver this injunction. And it just reported in the paper that the marshals had shown up at the Lorraine Motel. And then there was a photograph deeper in the newspaper that showed King and some of his entourage standing on the balcony, and behind him you can see the number 306. So it really wasn't difficult for Ray to figure out where King's group was. He comes downtown on the 4th of April and starts looking around and is lucky enough to find a dilapidated flop house that has some rooms that back up to the Lorraine. And he ends up checking into one of those rooms and starts kind of spying on King's group, trying to figure out their movements. He checked in to room 5B and paid a whole week's rent. So he clearly thought he was going to be there a while. I don't think he thought, you know, something's going to happen today. I think he thought he'd be there for the march that was planned and, you know, something would come up. But lo and behold, King comes out on the balcony. It's just before 6 o'clock and stays up there in this incredibly exposed place for 6-7 minutes. No one's, for whatever reason, no one in his group told him to move. He felt comfortable up there. He was in a great mood. He was joshing and joking with his staff and having a great time. And, he didn't have a Secret Service detail. He was a private citizen, and he wouldn't allow any members of his group to carry weapons or, you know, project. You know, it violated his Gandhian principles.
Yes.
To have anything like that. So there he was up there for all those minutes.
Let's go to Milton. Thanks, Jim, for your call. We have lines open, 800-486-8655. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask all the listeners to grab a pen and write down the words MLK trial 1999 Jowers, which is spelled Jowers, and the word pepper. And if you put those words into a search engine, you can find out about the King family's civil suit about the King assassination, which for some reason, even though it was a real trial with real investigators and a real judge and a real jury and real lawyers presenting real evidence, everybody wants to forget about this one. And now we seem to have a little industry springing up with television shows on PBS and now this book to kind of reinforce, very often through speculation and literary devices, to prop up the official story of Martin Luther King's death.
And again, all right. Well, I think you ought to read Hampton's book, Milton, too, because it's pretty well researched. What do you, and you know about that trial? What do you make of it?
Well, I read the transcript and I talked to journalists who covered it closely, and I've talked to lawyers who followed it closely, and I read Pepper's book. Of course, I've read all this stuff. That trial is a real interesting and real strange thing. The guy Lloyd Jowers was convicted of being as part of a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. Jowers, you know, comes forward with this story some 20 years after the incident, and he says that a black man had actually killed Martin Luther King. Then he changed his story to a white man. Then he agrees to go on trial, but he doesn't appear in the trial. He clearly wants to be convicted. His lawyer does not offer up a single objection. And the testimony that is given in this trial is mostly video that is shown without attribution, unnamed sources that make accusations about Jowers that he then does not object. He didn't object once. This was not an adversarial trial. This was a kind of a show trial. He wanted to be convicted. He was finally convicted and had to give a grand total of $100 to the King family as for reparations or whatever. And then Jowers just sort of disappeared from the scene. It was clear to people, local investigators and journalists who went into the Jowers story, that he was hoping to sell his story and that he would be part of the Oliver Stone movie project that was going on at the time. So it's a very strange trial, this civil trial. I know that some members of the King family got some sense of closure from it, or some sense of, solace from it, from knowing that a jury had said it looks like there's evidence of a conspiracy. But otherwise, this trial was a complete farce.
Isn't it strange? Well, it's not strange, but all these things, when there are major events like this, and particularly in the life of King, who was moving people where many people didn't want to go and were appalled by where he wanted to bring people, that you get all these huge subplots that are taking place.
Yeah.
There are conspiracy theories, but there are people in the family who want to believe this, and there's, you know, Ray and his whole weird mind thing and the hypnotist. There's just so much. What's the right word for it? It's just, it's complicated and it's kind of gooey.
Yeah, it's like a deep pond and you stick your toe in it and, you can very easily drown.
Right.
The conspiracy theories are interesting. I mean, conspiracy is part of human nature. It's absolutely understandable. There will always be conspiracy theories surrounding this case. And
sure.
And my book will do nothing to change them. I'm convinced of that. Those who want to believe in conspiracies, read Pepper's book, absolutely. And, Pepper points the finger at four or five other people. He actually points the finger at a Green Beret who was up there supposedly on a roof, was going to assassinate King. Almost did, but didn't in the end. He names him by name, thinking that he's dead. But, in fact, this guy, this Green Beret, was alive and well and living in Costa Rica. And he came up to America, confronted Pepper face-to-face. You don't want to tick off a Green Beret. And ended up winning a multi-million-dollar judgment against this guy, Pepper. So Pepper sort of had to back down on that charge. Then he said, no, I found the actual killer. His name is Raul, the mysterious Raul that Ray had talked about as being the real killer. And basically he went up to upstate New York and plucked a Raul out of the phone book. And formally accused him of the murder of Martin Luther King. This guy didn't speak any English. He was part of the Portuguese community up there. He had worked in a factory that had clear records that he had punched in that day, April 4th. Basically, it's just like Raul is like one of the most common names in the Hispanic culture. It's like saying John or something. But he plucked this name out and accused him. And so then he had to back down from that one. It was just sort of this desperation to point the finger at anyone but Ray.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. Thanks, Milton, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is the author of Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. Hampton Sides is our guest. Our email is talk@wpr.org. If you'd like to send us one of those, that would be okay. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have some lines open if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. I was thinking when you describe this immense fatigue and worry about death threats and King's incredible schedule and not being able to sleep, etc., of the toll on him or anybody. I mean, he probably was holding this too close to his heart, but to have those kinds of death threats, obviously there were people out there, and that's kind of frightening to think of, who were similar to Ray, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely a culture of hate in 1968 that was very, very much alive and well. And, Wallace was sort of the tip of the iceberg. He tried to make it respectable by talking about states' rights and big government and, those themes, and not so directly talking about race, as at least not as directly as he had talked about when he was governor of Alabama. But there was all these little groups and a number of bounties on King's head, and I think a lot of heated barroom talk. Mostly, you could probably discount a lot of it, but certainly there were some serious bounties out there, and I do think that Ray hoped to connect with one and may have connected with one. There's some evidence that he knew about one that emanated from St. Louis and from a businessman there who had offered $50,000 to the first person who would kill King. So these groups were out there, and there was right. some chatter, and you know there was definitely probably if Ray hadn't done it, there probably were other people waiting in the wings.
So let's talk a little bit more about Wallace, because it seems to me as though this issue of race is still playing out, and I'm wondering how fully it plays out in James Earl Ray's decision to assassinate King, because he was such a Wallace supporter. The fact that Wallace said, as you quote him in your book, let him call me a racist, he tells a reporter in Cleveland, it don't make any difference. Whole heap of folks in this country feel the same way I do. Race is going to win this thing for me. He calls the civil rights legislation that Johnson had pushed through Congress an assassin's knife stuck in the back of liberty. He says that the Negro would still be in Africa in the brush if the white people of this country had not raised their standards.
Right.
These are pretty inflammatory statements.
A little, you know, he certainly had his unguarded moments.
Where right.
He reverted back to the old Wallace, but he did try to kind of make more palatable his racial views by talking states' rights and things like that. He was a smart enough politician to know that he had to clean up his act a little bit. That was a more unguarded moment that you just read from. But you know, and of course today there's just all kinds of stuff like this. This culture of hate is still very
yes.
very alive today, and the internet especially has become this echo chamber that amplifies it, and you know these people find each other, and they're fellow travelers, you know, that talk about, you know, either they're racist or these views about socialism and the, you know, the government is going in a direction they don't like, and we should, you know, take up arms and
right.
take back the government, all this kind of talk.
Right.
It's very scary and very, you know, like Mark Twain used to say that history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. And I think, you know, it's definitely rhyming in a lot of scary ways right now.
I was thinking of that as I was reading your book, that a lot of the same fears and worries, which, you know, are meaningless, are surfacing now, too. And it is frightening. It is
yeah.
it is frightening.
Yeah, I mean, it only takes one guy, too, to sort of
right.
pick up these signals and maybe slightly misinterpret them and think that they mean literally, you know, pick up a gun and take aim at history. And unfortunately, we have a long and sordid line of these losers out there who are also, you know, they're lost souls, but they're also in some way kind of ambitious, and they want recognition, and they want to change history and connect with history, and this is the easiest way for them to do it.
Yeah. Art in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Interesting show. What I've generally heard in terms of why many people think there must be a conspiracy behind what Earl did is that he seemed to be able to travel at great expense and wouldn't normally be expected to have those kind of resources, so there had to be some backing behind him.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Thanks for the question. I think money is probably the single biggest question that people have. It's completely legitimate. It's completely, you know, certainly that I looked into a lot. And I don't have all the answers, but Ray, first of all, the FBI and certainly the House Select Committee on Assassinations, when they investigated this question of money, they zeroed in on a bank robbery that happened in Alton, Illinois, in just a couple of months after Ray escaped from prison. They were never able to solve this crime, but descriptions of the robbers sort of fit the Ray family. When I say the Ray family, I mean James Earl Ray and his two brothers. And this robbery netted $30,000. So that's a possibility. Another thing is that Ray, in his memoirs, talks a lot about what he did during his fugitive travels and talks about how he pulled stick-ups, did some gun running and other contraband running, did some smuggling and fencing. So I think, you know, clearly he was making money through his old tried-and-true methods as a kind of a low-grade hood. He talked in various points in his memoirs about wanting to pull stick-ups, of banks, of grocery stores. When he gets finally to London and is about to get caught, and he's clearly running out of money, he's clearly desperate, he robs a jewelry store and then he robs a bank. So, you know, if he's part of an extremely well-funded conspiracy, why is he doing this? Why is he risking everything and exposing himself in this way? He's clearly desperate for money. So, you know, I think that the question of money is always going to be there. Ray never really came clean exactly on all his sources of money, but those are some of the explanations for how he funded his travels. The other side of the ledger is that James Earl Ray lived extremely cheaply, except for these couple of plane tickets that he bought and his bartending course that he took in L.A. By and large, he was living quite cheaply in these flop houses. He ate in his room. He was a cheapskate. You know, he's living on less than $5 a day. And, you know, so, you know, people think that he was living this life high on the hog or something, but he certainly was not. And he didn't need a lot of money to get from place to place.
Anything else, Art?
Well, just that it's a little scary today when you talk about Wallace's impact on someone like Ray, whether he was acting on his own or not. And you look at some of the movements today in our president. It is a little bit scary.
Yeah. They always seem to be with us, unfortunately. Thanks, Art, very much for the call. And take us to Heathrow. He gets caught at Heathrow, and he's about to really escape into history, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he really, I don't think many people realize how close he came to getting to making it, to getting to Rhodesia, which was where he was heading. He wanted to be a mercenary soldier down there, and he had this idea that he'd get down there, and they would embrace him, and if they ever discovered that he was King's assassin, they would, you know, they would welcome him as a hero and not extradite him. They didn't have a treaty with the United States. So he would be beyond the scope of prosecution. That was his plan, and, you know, maybe not a terrible one. He might have made it. He was on a plane to Brussels when they caught him, where he was hoping to connect with one of these mercenary groups that he'd been told about. He almost made it on that plane, but for a passport irregularity that tipped off a signal to some of the customs people that they were looking for a guy named Ramon Snead. They didn't know who Ramon Snead was. They didn't know he was the assassin, or at least the accused assassin of Martin Luther King. They were just picking him up for routine check because his name was on a list. But they caught him. They found out that he was James Earl Ray. And he denied it, of course. He said, no, I'm Ramon Snead. And they got me mixed up with this other guy, and James Earl Ray. I've never heard of him before. Hmm. And then he tells his lawyer, but in the meantime, while I'm here, can you contact my brother back in America? Mm. And the lawyer says, well, of course. What is his name? Jerry Ray. So it's sort of like, okay, is your name Ray or is your name Snead?
Right.
And it became very clear that they had the right guy.
They had the guy. And Coretta Scott King returns to Memphis in her widow's dressing and has the march.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a remarkable scene. And she was just so sort of pitch perfect in that very difficult role, which was, you know, King was going to march down Beale Street and down Main Street to City Hall with the garbage workers. And that was the march he wanted to do and was never able to do. So 3 days after the assassination, she comes to Memphis and leads this march and is so composed and so elegant and able to hold it together under the most difficult circumstances. And there was one woman who said that if she had cried a single tear, the city would have give way, as she put it. The
yes.
city would have broken apart. But she held it together and was just the picture of elegance.
Mm. And your father? You were young for all of this. You were six. How did your father respond to this?
Well, I mean, it was devastating to him and to everyone who worked in that law firm.
I'm sure.
You know, it was also a very controversial moment in the city's history because my father was, I guess you would consider, politically moderate, but he was liberal on race questions. And, you know, being I think in the time, the most controversial, the most, I think, most important issue in the South. And so he got a lot of criticism from friends for, you know, working on these cases and representing these people and, you know, being a nigger lover and all this kind of stuff. Times have changed a lot, and, you know, Memphis is still got its problems, but it's, you know, it's you know, very different times.
Hampton, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the book. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Mm-hmm. Hampton Sides, the book is Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production. I will not be with you tomorrow. My little boy is graduating from high school, and it's also a furlough day, so I'm going to go to the ceremony, and I'll be with you again on Tuesday. Have a wonderful weekend. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.